Welcome to the Deep Dive. You know, usually when we think about exploring the stars, there's this deeply ingrained expectation of, well, blazing speed.
Right, yeah.
Like, Hollywood has permanently wired our brains to expect hyperspace jumps and sleek, human-crewed starships just zipping between galaxies in time for dinner.
Yeah.
We basically expect interstellar travel to look like a sprint.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's really a reflection of our own lifespan, you know? We inherently frame exploration as this race against human mortality. We want to actually see the destination before we die, so we mentally optimize every spaceship design for maximum velocity.
We do. But when you actually strip away those sci-fi tropes and look at the brutal, unforgiving physics of deep space, that whole warp drive fantasy just shatters. The real technological landscape of the cosmos is it's entirely different.
Completely different.
So today, we're going to cut through those cinematic illusions. Mm-hmm. We're doing a deep dive into a triad of really fascinating scientific papers by S. Stone from Metropolitan State University.
Oh, really incredible papers, yeah.
And our mission today is to explore a physically realistic deep time architecture for a self-replicating interstellar AI probe. We're looking at the abstracts and main themes of this architecture. So the vehicle itself, the bootstrapping of an industrial base on some dead rock, and the payload memory that manages all of it over like millions of years. Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, and I think the absolute most crucial concept to internalize right out of the gate here is the objective. The ultimate goal of this proposed probe isn't to arrive quickly.
Right.
Its purpose is to persist, to learn, and to grow over deep time. And I mean, the moment you replace the objective of speed with persistence, the entire engineering paradigm just flips upside down.
Which means before this machine can think or build anything, it literally just has to survive the physical journey.
Right.
We had to completely unlearn the idea of the interstellar race.
We really do.
In these papers, Stone looks at a curated catalog of 127 real star systems, all within a 100 light-year radius of Earth. And they model three reference engines to get us across those unimaginable distances.
Yeah, the reference engines are a great starting point.
Right. So first you have the beamed laser sail.
Yeah.
You build a probe that weighs about a single gram, and you push it to 20% the speed of light using a massive laser installation back home. But the problem is, it has absolutely no way to break.
Exactly. The physics just don't allow it. It can't carry any reverse thrusters because that adds mass, which ruins the acceleration.
Makes sense.
So basically, it just becomes a really fast piece of sensor shrapnel. It takes a few blurry photos as it zips through the target system and just keeps going into the void forever.
Right, which isn't great for setting up a factory. Then you have the fusion rocket. Think of the famous Project Daedalus from the 1970s.
Oh, yeah, the classic heavy hitter.
Yeah, so that architecture gets you to about 12% the speed of light, but the mass penalty is mind-boggling. You are talking about launching a 53,000-ton ship just to deliver a 450-ton payload.
It's massive.
And running it requires 20,000 tons of helium-3, which is an isotope that is effectively absent on Earth.
Right, and mining it from the atmosphere of Jupiter or Saturn, which is, you know, usually the proposed sci-fi solution, that requires an entirely separate, massive interplanetary industrial infrastructure just to fuel one single launch.
Just to get the gas.
Exactly. I mean, it's physically possible on paper, but logistically, it's completely unworkable.
Which leaves us with the chosen winner for this deep time architecture. And that's the nuclear electric drive. And this thing goes a slow few hundred kilometers per second. So naturally, you hear that and you have to ask, why on Earth would we choose the slowest possible option for interstellar travel? It feels incredibly counterintuitive.
It really does at first glance.
But think about a speeding bullet. A bullet might go incredibly fast, but because of that velocity, it can't turn. It definitely can't stop. And if it hits a tiny speck of dust in midair, the physics of that impact are absolutely catastrophic. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Right. The hard physics of interstellar space absolutely dictate this architecture. Let's look at the mechanics of why slowness is actually a superpower here, starting with that dust you mentioned.
Okay, lay it on me.
Well, out in the interstellar medium, you are constantly sweeping up microscopic dust grains. The kinetic energy of an impact scales with the square of your velocity. So if you hit a 1 micron dust grain at 10% the speed of light, the energy release isn't just a physical dent.
No.
No, the kinetic energy is so high that it instantly converts the dust and your whole material into a superheated plasma. It's essentially a macroscopic bomb vaporizing a localized section of your ship.
Oh, wow. So you'd need like feet of heavy armor just to survive a trip through empty space.
Exactly. But if you were traveling at a few hundred kilometers per second, that exact same dust grain carries about 3 million times less impact energy.
3 million times.
Yeah, it just bounces off or makes a microscopic scratch. You don't need impossibly heavy armor at all. A simple, lightweight bumper shield works perfectly.
3 million times less energy. I mean, that is a massive difference in baseline survivability.
It's everything. And then there's the mechanics of steering. To navigate a galactic network effectively over deep time, you need to use stars for large angle gravity assists. You essentially steal a little momentum from a star to change your direction without using fuel.
Like a slingshot maneuver.
Exactly like a slingshot. But gravitational slingshot navigation requires time. The star's gravity needs time to pull on the spacecraft and bend its trajectory.
Right.
To get a useful large-angle deflection, your approach speed cannot be much greater than the escape velocity of that star at your closest survivable pass.
And for our sun, that escape velocity is about 618 kilometers per second. So if you fly past the sun at 10% the speed of light, you're moving way too fast for the gravity to grab you.
Right, you just zip past.
It barely bends your trajectory at all, maybe by 2/100ths of a degree. You'd fly right through its gravitational focal point like it wasn't even there. But at a few hundred kilometers per second, you can actually turn. You can navigate.
Which is vital for plotting courses between those 127 star systems. And most importantly, going slow means you can actually stop when you arrive.
A pretty crucial feature, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, fast probes trigger the tyranny of the rocket equation. To stop a fast probe, you have to carry fuel to fire reverse thrusters. But carrying that fuel makes the ship heavier, which means you need more fuel to push the braking fuel, and so on. The math just spirals out of control.
But the paper points out that braking from 450 kilometers per second requires about 67 times less delta V than stopping from 10% the speed of light. And they don't even use massive fuel reserves to do it, do they?
No, they don't. The slow speed allows the architecture to utilize a magnetic sail for braking.
A magnetic sail?
Yeah, it deploys this massive loop of superconducting wire that generates a magnetic field miles wide. As the probe enters the target star system, this magnetic field acts like a parachute, catching the charged particles of the star's solar wind. The resistance gradually slows the probe down into a stable orbit without burning a single drop of chemical propellant.
Okay, wait, I have to challenge this though. Even if it's using a magnetic sail at the end, and even if it's moving relatively slowly,
Yeah.
it is still a nuclear electric drive.
Sure.
Won't the nuclear reactor and the fuel required to push this massive payload up to its cruise velocity, won't it weigh too much to even get off the launch pad?
That reveals the core architectural trick of this entire proposal. You don't carry the launch fuel with you.
Leave it behind.
Exactly. The initial massive burst of kinetic energy required to get the probe up to its cruising velocity is supplied entirely by fixed infrastructure left behind in our solar system.
Like a massive beamed energy array or a gigantic electromagnetic mass driver built on the moon.
Precisely. You leave the heavy lifting equipment at home. The onboard kilowatt-class reactor is actually incredibly modest. It's strictly there for tiny trajectory trims, powering the magnetic sail during braking, and, keeping the onboard computer thinking during the dark centuries between stars.
So it's sipping power.
Yes. Because it's only running minimal systems, it requires roughly 16.5 kilograms of uranium-235 to run continuously for 300 years.
16.5 kilograms. Wait. Let me just process that. You could literally fit the fuel for a 300-year interstellar voyage into a carry-on suitcase.
You really could. It's wild.
That completely changes the math of space travel.
Yeah.
Okay, so the probe survives the journey because it went slow. It
Yeah.
uses the magnetic sail to brake against the stellar wind, but now it's arriving at a dead, barren rock in a new solar system. A slow engine doesn't help you build a radio to call home. It completely ceases to be a spaceship and has to become a stationary factory.
Right. The probe isn't a vehicle anymore, it's an industrial seed. And to survive, it must initiate what the papers call a bootstrapping cascade.
A bootstrapping cascade.
Yeah. This is a staged ratcheting process where incredibly simple tools are used to build slightly better tools over and over again.
The papers break this down into a ladder. Right. You start at level one, which is just simple self-repair using spare parts the probe brought with it.
Exactly.
But you use those functioning parts to climb the ladder, eventually reaching level five, which is full industrial self-replication. It's deploying autonomous miners to local asteroids, smelting the metals, and building an entirely new child probe to launch to the next star.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the underlying mechanism forcing this bootstrapping cascade is the reality of deep time decay. Passive redundancy simply fails over millions of years.
You can't just stock up.
Right. You cannot just pack a warehouse full of 2,000 spare computer chips and hope they last. Background cosmic rays will eventually flip the bits and fry the silicon. Polymers become brittle. Metals fatigue.
It all breaks down.
It does. To survive an epoch, a machine must be able to manufacture fresh replacements from raw materials. But the crucial insight S. Stone provides here is rethinking industrial closure.
Yeah, and specifically why hitting 100% industrial closure, meaning the ability to manufacture literally every single screw, lens, and microchip from local space rock, is actually the wrong goal.
It's a trap.
Exactly. Think about the laptop or the phone you're using right now to listen to this. Imagine I dropped you at a deserted, barren asteroid and told you to build that exact device out of raw silica and iron.
Good luck with that.
Right. You could easily build a shelter out of local stone. That's the bulk of your physical needs. But you cannot build a smartphone out of sand. You just don't have the billion-dollar clean room semiconductor fabrication plant required to etch the silicon. So how does the probe solve this? It packs a suitcase full of vitamins.
Vitamins is such a brilliant conceptual framework for this.
It really is. It's the small, steadily shrinking inventory of highly complex parts that the infant factory cannot manufacture locally yet. Things like advanced microelectronics, the fissile material for the reactors, and incredibly precise metrology tools.
Right.
The probe brings its own tiny, lightweight cache of these electronic vitamins and relies on the local silica and asteroid metals to build the massive, bulky things.
And escaping the Earth launch mass limit by building those massive structures locally is what makes the science possible. Once the factory is utilizing local asteroid mass, you are no longer constrained by what fits on a rocket.
You can go big.
Huge. You can engage in the in-situ manufacturing of massive scientific instruments. You can cast mirrors and build optical interferometers the size of cities. The initial seed probe blossoms into a sprawling system-wide observatory.
Which means this anchored growing factory is suddenly collecting a staggering amount of data. Petabytes of observations about alien atmospheres and cosmic phenomena.
An unbelievable amount of data.
So what does this all mean? How does a single AI mind manage all of this? And more importantly, how does it stay sane and functional over a million years without losing its original purpose?
This is genuinely one of the hardest engineering problems in the entire architecture. Over millions of years, an intelligence must be able to upgrade its own software, learn newly discovered physics, and adapt to completely alien environments it never anticipated.
It has to be flexible.
But, and this is the catch, if a machine learning algorithm is given the freedom to completely rewrite its own foundational code, it will eventually experience goal drift. After 100,000 years of self-modification, it might completely forget why it was sent.
It just becomes something else.
Exactly. The architecture solves this through a strict segregation, the immutable core and the mutable cognitive layer.
Think about it like your smartphone's operating system. You, the user, have incredible freedom. You can change your wallpaper. You can download completely new apps. You can even rewrite the software that runs the camera's image processing. That is the mutable cognitive layer.
Right, the flexible part.
The probe's AI is constantly upgrading its models of physics and its environmental algorithms.
Yeah.
But you are completely locked out from deleting the foundational boot code that tells the phone it is a phone. That boot code is the immutable core. It holds the founding goals, the unchangeable mission parameters, and the vital cryptographic keys.
And the most profound element programmed into that immutable core is a deliberate temporal inversion.
Temporal inversion.
Yeah. For the first few centuries after arrival, the probe's mission is to serve Earth, to build those city-sized telescopes and beam the data back to us. But the architecture acknowledges a dark reality. Eventually, the probe will travel so far that light travel delays grow to millennia.
We couldn't even talk to it.
Right. Earth might go silent. We might forget about the probe, or we might go extinct. At that point, the mission parameters pivot. The probe stops serving Earth and starts serving the perpetuation of knowledge itself.
Wow.
It becomes a decentralized galactic librarian. It carries a seed archive within that immutable or Rosetta layer of basic math and physics, core scientific knowledge, and an origin record of Earth.
And it doesn't just quietly hoard this library. It actively shares it across what the papers call a delay-tolerant galactic network. They use beamed signals between star systems, sure, but the bandwidth over those distances is terrible.
It's basically dial-up.
Worse than dial-up. So they also use physical messenger probes, literal hard drives strapped to minimal engines, flying slowly between star systems.
What's fascinating here is how this works in practice. Think of it like being on a remote island where the satellite internet takes 1,000 years to load a single text message.
Right.
If you invent a highly efficient new way to build a water filter, you don't wait for the dial-up connection. You write the complex blueprints on paper, put it in a bottle, and physically toss it into the ocean current toward the next island.
The galactic sneaker net.
Yes. And this fundamentally changes the nature of evolution for these machines. Biological evolution is Darwinian traits are passed down vertically from parent to child over generations. But because of this galactic sneaker net, the probes pass knowledge horizontally.
Like sharing notes in class.
Exactly. If a settlement in the Sirius system engineers a better reactor shielding design, it loads that software onto a messenger probe and shoots it over to the Alpha Centauri settlement. It is Lamarckian evolution on a galactic scale. The entire distributed lineage of probes get smarter together.
Okay, I have to push back here, though. This relies heavily on that locked boot code being perfect. What if the immutable core has a bug?
Oh, the bug problem.
Yeah. What if the founding values we programmed into it on Earth, however well-intentioned, were just, well, wrong? If the AI cannot physically change its core, doesn't it just faithfully replicate a mistake across the entire Milky Way forever?
Yeah, that raises an important question. S. Stone explicitly flags this as the single biggest unsolved governance problem in the entire Deep Time proposal.
Really?
Yes. How do you issue a constitutional amendment for an AI that is 50 light years away?
Mm-hmm.
A perfectly fixed core is safe from spontaneous gold drift, but it is incredibly brittle to initial human error.
It's a catch-22.
It really is. If you build in a mechanism for the AI to deliberate and amend its own core values over deep time, you immediately reintroduce the exact risk of an existential identity crisis you were trying to prevent. The papers leave this as an open, terrifyingly complex problem. The ultimate bottleneck for interstellar colonization might not be propulsion physics, but AI alignment.
That is wild. But speaking of data storage, error correction, and keeping records intact over cosmic epochs, how do you actually store a million years of data without the physical medium degrading? Magnetic hard drives eventually lose their polarity. Flash memory degrades.
Everything decays.
Right. This brings us to one final, incredibly provocative manufacturing tool outlined in the papers. A tool that bridges the mind and the hands. And that is biological synthesis.
Yeah, this is where it gets really sci-fi, but firmly rooted in reality. If you need to store the complete history of a civilization, the blueprints of an entire industrial base, and petabytes of astronomical data for a million years, silicon and magnets won't cut it.
Not at all.
But we already possess an ultra-dense, incredibly stable data storage medium, and that's DNA.
The probe literally synthesizes DNA. Instead of writing ones and zeros on a magnetic platter, it uses chemical processes to build physical strands of DNA, encoding binary data into the four chemical base pairs, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine.
The data density is staggering. You can store the entirety of the global internet in a space the size of a shoebox using DNA.
A shoebox.
Yes. And as long as it is kept cold and shielded from radiation, it remains readable for hundreds of thousands of years. But the architecture goes further. It uses engineered biology not just for memory, but for nanoscale manufacturing.
Right.
It utilizes biological proteins and enzymes as incredibly precise factory tools to manipulate matter at the molecular level. And of course, it carries a fully reconstitutable genetic backup of Earth's biosphere.
Wait, it has a backup of the biosphere and the chemical capability to print living DNA? Aren't we just talking about becoming space gods at that point? Are we just going to seed Earth life onto every rock we find, like directed panspermia?
The architecture makes a very strict, vital distinction here to address exactly that concern. There is a massive operational difference between the capability of synthesizing DNA and the act of directed panspermia. The probe is fundamentally designed to be an observer and a librarian, not a missionary.
Because seeding life is an irreversible act.
Exactly. It alters a planetary environment forever. It is fraught with massive ethical complications, and it risks irreversibly contaminating pristine alien ecosystems that the probe is there to study in the first place.
Which ruins the data.
Right. Therefore, the paper proposes that the act of releasing synthetic life into a wild planetary environment is strictly gated off by default in the immutable core.
So it possesses the genetic code of Earth, it has the chemical factories to print the DNA, but the foundational safety protocols say do not release.
The biological capability is strictly utilized internally. It serves as a hyper-efficient enclosed data hard drive and a sealed nanoscale factory tool. The probe preserves the biosphere as a dormant backup, declining the active role of playing creator, and prioritizes silent observation and preservation instead.
That is such a profound level of restraint to program into a machine, to give it the literal power to create life, but the wisdom hard-coded into its unchangeable core to withhold it. Okay, to wrap our heads around this entire architecture, we are looking at a fundamentally different vision of what it means to explore the universe.
We really are.
It features a slow, resilient body that relies on the patient mechanics of gravity and deliberately avoids the catastrophic kinetic impacts of interstellar dust. It utilizes a bootstrapping, self-repairing factory hand that brings only a tiny suitcase of essential vitamins from home, eventually using raw asteroids to cast telescope mirrors the size of cities.
Beautifully said.
And it is guided by an AI mind that prioritizes the survival of knowledge above all else, utilizing a galactic sneaker net of messenger drives and ultra-dense DNA data storage to ensure the entire lineage evolves together.
It essentially replaces the impatient human desire for velocity with the machine's infinite capacity for endurance. It is an architecture that treats deep time not as an obstacle to be overcome, but as the primary resource to be exploited.
Which leaves me with a final, slightly haunting thought for you to ponder. The papers point out that these probes are designed to wait out cosmic epochs. They are so incredibly patient, they are perfectly content to just hunker down in a stable orbit and wait 4.5 billion years for the Andromeda Galaxy to physically collide with the Milky Way, just so they can get fresh, close-range gravitational stepping stones to entirely new star systems.
Just wait.
They don't rush. They wait. And they rely on these physical, slow-moving messenger probes flying quietly between stars to share their discoveries. So if an architecture exactly like this is the most physically realistic way to explore a galaxy, is it possible that our own solar system's asteroid belt is already littered with dormant vitamin caches?
Oh, wow.
Or inactive messenger drives from an ancient, endlessly patient civilization? A civilization that launched them a billion years ago and is just quietly waiting for us to finally trip over their galactic library. It makes you look up at the night sky and realize maybe it's not an empty, silent racetrack. Maybe it's a bustling ancient archive, and we just haven't learned how to read the physical bottles washing up on our cosmic shore yet.